afternoon, everybody. This is Robin Ayoub from the Localization Fireside Chat, and welcome to another episode. Welcome to another recording. With this recording, I think I'm recording episode 200. And today, my guest of honor, I can't wait to get to know Talia Barush. I'm hoping I'm pronouncing the last name correctly. Wow, here you go. My people. I speak Arabic. I'm used to the sound.
You can speak our native dialects, yes.
That's right. So Talia Barush is joining me from San Francisco, where currently it's morning for her. It's afternoon for me. And I've got two objectives today. I want to get to know Talia. And we've crossed our industry, our career crossed a little bit at some point. We worked for the same company at some point. And I'd like to get to know Talia on a personal level. I'd love to get to know a little bit about Global Sake, which I can't wait to see you in San Francisco at the end of April. Got a lot of things we need to cover in this episode. Welcome to the channel, Talia.
Thank you so much for having me.
I really appreciate you being with me. Thanks so much again for taking the time. My first question for you and everybody on this channel, that's the first question they get. So we call it the story question. What is your story? What got you here?
Okay, so you have to, I'm going to have to take you in the time machine all the way to my infancy. So my grandparents, my father is from Bukhara, Tashkent, the Silk Road, Uzbekistan. So very, very, very rich culture of the East. And my mom is from England, was born in England, but from, the family is from Vienna and Brno in Czechoslovakia. So my grandparents lived in England, and that East and West fed into the home, you know, the way the ambience in the house, you know, it's not just about languages, it's about attitude and life perspective and values, very much about values. And every year since we were born, as the kids, myself and my brothers, we would go to the full summer break, the 2 months to my grandparents' in England, in the village. It was called Yuzdin, the house of the yew tree. This is why my independent consulting business is called User, so YEW User, as a tribute, as an honoring of that, of Yuzdin. And really at Yuzdin was a metaphor for really what brought me later, fast forward a few decades forward, to choose this localization. I mean, at the time there was no such thing. I stumbled on the term localization when I was looking in a newspaper for a job in San Diego when we moved there 25 years ago, and there was a job opening for a localization manager. And that was a new, basically kind of the inception days of localization of the industry. And just from the description, I fell in love. I started my career as a literary transcreator, actually. So very much coming from applied linguistics and very much from the content heart. So transadapted, transcreated poetry of Broadway shows. And then that lended itself to other creative content marketing, Marcom, and then to localization management. Did that at Google, VMware, also on the vendor side at Lionbridge. Was there for, that was my first big kind of entry level job, 5 years at Lionbridge, and then other companies. And then about 15 years ago, I pivoted to product and growth. So applied that content adaptation for cultural relevancy and regional fit to how the product behaves. And I just want to say one more thing maybe about Yuzdin, because it was a safe haven. My grandfather was a woodworker. You know, this is right after Second World War, and they built this safe haven place. It was really a utopian, you know, a what if after the horrors of the First and Second World Wars, this was going to be and was for many people, for the refugees of the Second World War. This was a safe haven for people to be in and maybe envision humanity without cruelty and humanity with union, with tolerance and acceptance of all cultures and faiths and backgrounds. And so as a kid being there, you know, Karl Popper, the famous philosopher, was a good friend of my grandfather's, and other Bauhaus, Bohemians from around the world, regularly visited. And as kids, you know, being there immersed in these multicultural, multiple accents and viewpoints was really a very founding trigger.
Absolutely. And, you know, what a fascinating journey you've had. You know, I looked at the number of initiatives you're involved in so far in the past and currently. You had about 16, 17 different initiatives on the go from your beginning of the career till now. What a fascinating journey, Talia, and what a pleasure to have you on the channel just to tell your story, you know, versus what we're going to be talking about today as well, the Global Sake, which will come out in a second here. For the audience and for those who don't know Talia, Talia is on LinkedIn. Feel free to look up Talia Baruch, and it spells B-A-R-U-C-H. And Talia and I, we pronounce the letter very well. So we save you the trouble of saying it in a fanatical way. So I appreciate you guys. If you can't find Talia on LinkedIn, look me up and I would be happy to make an introduction. And just one more thing on Talia here, as we fast forward into the today's world, into today's 2026. Talia is known as a global growth executive, 20 years leading international expansion products and growth marketing at Google, LinkedIn, SurveyMonkey, and is a localization and internationalization expert. In 2017, she founded something called Global Saki, which we'll get to know a little bit here in a second. And it's a global community with 3,000 plus cross-functional tech leader driving international expansion. In 2023, she launched LocLearn, training professionals in international product management to upskill certificate courses. They're included in that as well. So hopefully I did you justice there. I don't know. I did some research on you, Talia. Hopefully I hit a few points that they're exact, or if I'm off a little bit, correct me. Don't be shy. So for the audience, Global Saki began as a movement for sharing interdisciplinary industry insights, leading interactive networking experiences across the globe. And the leader of this is Talia and her teammates, who pushed this initiative to the surface to make it really a force in the industry. Now, I've heard about Global Saki on many years and many occasions, and today is, I guess, better than late, how do they say that? It's late better than never kind of thing. So we're having to have a conversation about Global Saki on the Localization Fireside Chat, because I really want the audience to know, especially the audience that they're not from the industry. And just FYI for everybody, we have a lot of viewers that are coming in from outside the industry looking to find out about the industry. And so this is an education as well as it is information to the existing people in the industry as well. So now a question for you, Talia, if you don't mind. You spent 20 years at Google, LinkedIn, SurveyMonkey, watching how global expansion actually gets done. What was the thing that kept you in saying things are going wrong?
Yeah, so for decades, and still in many companies, this is still the case, companies are, if you like, sharded into functional teams, right? So you have product teams that have the different functional representations, right? The user researcher, the data scientist, the engineers, the UX designers, and so on. And they're responsible for a specific code base, for a specific part of the user journey, right? And then you have the localization team, which typically, you know, and historically has been either part of engineering or QA at best, or maybe, you know, tucked downstream somewhere in a not necessarily having the seat at the table. And this is also true for a lot of horizontal efforts, right? Like mobile platforms, things that really cut across multiple functions. And when it comes to international, it's very critical to have alignment. I had to always align when I was in the product org, I had to always align my international OKRs with every single functional lead, team lead across the org, because I'm not going to execute. My team will not execute on everything I put in the PRD, right? So, and also I would definitely say that the paradigm has always been, and now is due to the technology starting to shift, but the paradigm has always been English US first, non-English, non-US later. And that really informed how companies are built, how organizations are structured, how product dev, you know, dev design delivery workflow is managed. And obviously that put the localization and the all international efforts as a tail end later, right?
It's an afterthought.
That's an afterthought. When it's an afterthought, there's always a feature gap. All the multitude, you know, the higher percentage of growth potential, obviously, and of usability being outside of the English US category, are getting the older versions, are getting all kinds of feature gaps, experiences, not all the support that the English US gets. Now, with there's a reason for that, because it was historically expensive and timely to offer quality multilingual, multi-geo support. Right? And so there was a reason for that. And then when companies launch, you know, their startups, their scale-ups, they're still lean with budget and resources. However, you know, of course, now the technology brings us closer to that global first deployment and it's a great time now to really act on that mind shift for you know, the concept of domestic versus international is simply not relevant. We're building products for the world, right? So unless it's a very, very specific domestic use case, we are building a feature for, it's for everyone. For everyone, it needs to be designed for everyone, right? It's more than language. So I would say that, yeah, maybe key things that I always felt were wrong and needed to be resolved were the functional silos, especially when it comes to international efforts. When I was in the product teams, I did have a seat at the table, and I also had visibility to the executive OKRs, to the core objectives of the company. And so I was able to, with my teams, to act on trade-offs and do the right thing. But again, the system, the way it was structured, both on the platforms, you know, back-end, mid-tier, front-end workflows and team structure were not really designed for that. So that's one big problem, is the silos of functions. The second big problem was the concept of domestic versus international. You know, international is not a country, so it shouldn't be its own category. We should look at the world and at usability in terms of use case usability and user intent, wherever they are and whatever interface locale they use. Doesn't matter where and who they are and what language they speak. It shouldn't be a language situation. And again, now the technology brings us closer to that. And thirdly, yes, I would, talk about, you know, a major gap when it comes to product is we oftentimes, you know, when you prototype and ideate a problem you want to solve for and build a feature, a product for, right? You do some user research and market research. And if those are done in your domestic market, you are not gaining, maybe you're not solving for the right problem. You might be solving for, you'll be solving for the problem you've prototyped for, but not for the problems that you will be eventually launching for in other markets. The parts of the world. So yeah, I would say those are kind of the major gaps, I always say.
In your assessment, why do you think, for instance, a Global Sake as a community was the vehicle to support that idea of transformation from a product designed for English first versus for international first, as a vehicle to push that idea versus, let's say, a product or a consultancy company? Why the community versus a company, if you don't mind?
Sure. I think it's very grassroots. I think it has to come bottom up. So I've, of course, and I'm talking, representing myself, but I'm sure a lot of what I'm saying resonates with a lot of other folks in the industry driving international efforts over the past 20 years, is that it's, you know, we're doing as much as we can internal evangelism within our companies, but it's very difficult. This is probably the most difficult part of the job of any international, especially within product and localization. So yes, of course, within the company, I've certainly done a lot in internal evangelism, you know, including like bringing the actual stories of real users, you know, at LinkedIn, at SurveyMonkey, users from around the world, and what are their gaps, just everyday feature experience gaps and so on, you know, doing all those, you know, bringing cross-functional product leads to our local hubs and have them work from India, from Brazil, from Mexico City, to just continue doing their work, their engineering or UX design work, but just within the ecosystem of that new environment, and go outside and get coffee and see people in Mexico City, see people in Tokyo and talk to them and have a better understanding or visualization of who you are developing, designing products for. Right?
So a lot of those things. Yeah, a lot of times people ship products, they don't know who they shipped it to.
Exactly. A lot of times, I think also this blind side is that, and this is maybe more for US-based companies, is that it's only a language situation, right? So we build a great product that solves for a very important challenge. We translate, localize it, you know, we enable the language so that people from around the world can understand and use the product. But maybe the features, the workflow, the funnel, how they discover the product, how they're onboarding, the core feature, the core actions, the value proposition, those might not resonate or might need to be repositioned for those specific markets, right? I kind of look at it as, you know, what problem are we solving for? That defines our value proposition. And we oftentimes need to reposition that for different markets because of different segmentation and sectoring. Number two is who are we optimizing the solution for? Demographic, use case scenario, user intent. It's different in different markets based on the market maturity level as well. And three, how do we define and measure success, right? Those KPIs
cannot That's important.
And that's a big, big blind side at many, with many global companies where, as a consultant, I've worked with several companies where their data was clustered and organized based on US or let's say sometimes English core, right? So US, UK, Australia, Canada versus rest of world, right? Mm-hmm. You would have ROW for all the other data category. Where, you know, they couldn't have, they didn't really have the right country slice data insights. So the data informs our priority launch, right? And if the data is not organized in the right way, we're not getting the right insights.
Absolutely. And you know what? Speaking of data, 2017, you know, like in the Global Psyche Study in 2017, but that's years before AI became dominant in the conversation. You know, we can't have any conversation unless AI is part of it. How do you think this has shifted the community since AI became part of the conversation, Talia?
Yeah, so like you said, I started Global Psyche in 2017, and the goal there was to really, there were many others up to that point. I would join and be a speaker, you know, at all kinds of Lock World, you know, Taos, Gala, different. Several great localization industry communities, right, with events and great programming. I've always felt that it was kind of preaching to the choir because the people who would attend would come from the localization industry, and we already know our stuff. Like we don't need to be convinced. And I felt very strong need to build a community that actually brings in, of course, also the localization leads, but also the VPs of product and heads of marketing, heads of go-to-market strategy, heads of data science, and now AI and platforms that don't necessarily come from an international orientation, but are very savvy in their functional expertise. And so the premise, you know, Yo-Yo Ma has a famously a beautiful band that he put together of musicians that he handpicked from different parts of the world, literally from every continent. And each of them brings their own unique tempo and rhythm and musical instruments and history and mindset, right? And imagination context. And that forms and informs much stronger music creation, right? And in that same sense, the goal of Global Psyche has always been to do that. So to bring, you know, I believe that when people come together across functions, so different complementing expertise areas, across cultures and across regions, because of course now we're tapping into their collective environment, you know, understanding people within the cultural context of their environments, right? Then we can really solve big problems, because now we can tackle a problem not from the same way, not from the same pathway, but from, you know, we can start to have really different outlooks and come to the solution from very different angles, right? And that's much more meaningful.
Because we're putting our heads together, basically, instead of one thinking of a solution, now you've got the community thinking of the solution. Is that correct?
Yes, and really challenging the status quo, right? Because when we are locked, sometimes we're locked within our functional team or within our regional environment, we're locked into a specific way of thinking. And we can't really see another way unless we actually open the door.
We develop tunnel vision.
What?
We develop tunnel vision.
Yes, exactly. And so opening that conversation, and of course now with AI opens a lot of new possibilities. We know what's right now, and it's going to be very hard to predict what will be tomorrow, because really there are so many pathways that could, you know, possibilities that open up and then scale. And if you combine quantum computing to AI's technology, quantum has the promise within, you know, a few years, maybe three, max 5 years, to really power AI capabilities. So that would totally explode. If you're thinking we're already exploded, that would be a different dimension of explosion, right? So the possibilities are endless, you know, and we just need to keep an open, you know, just, we don't need to have all the answers. We can't. Every person has a million blind sides. But we can open our antennas so that we can be receptors of ideas and open to serendipitous encounters, right? And that's what Global Psyche is kind of creating, the physical platform for people to come together and have those cross-pollinate ideas and shared knowledge.
So speaking of Global Psyche, there is a conference coming up at the end of April in San Francisco. Can you talk to us a little bit about this?
Sure, yeah. Yeah, so once a year we put together, so there are multiple programs. You mentioned Lock Learn School. I started it to teach, I also taught at SF State here and at the Holt International Business School and at MIS, Middlebury Institute of International Studies. But I developed a course to teach international product management and years ago and then started Lock Learn to teach that, taught a few cohorts of that. But then I started to invite other experts specializing in specifically different AI expertise areas and training that. So we have the school, we have lock walks around the world. We typically have a lock walk somewhere around the world once a week. We had in Barcelona, in Tokyo, in even in Australia, Brisbane. We'll have our next one here in San Francisco in May. So check out the Lock Walk programs. These are free networking events. So there are multiple touch points. There's the monthly newsletters. And then once a year, we put together a big in-person event. And for many of our community members, this is kind of the annual reunion. So we have quite a bit of folks traveling from across Asia and Europe. And you yourself will be there from Canada.
I will be there. Yeah, I'm flying from Toronto.
Amazing. So excited to see you.
Me too.
And of course, our Bay Area folks and from across America. So this is a coming together. Historically, it's always been kind of like a world festival. So it's a celebration of multicultural. We always, of course, start with our signature sake tasting. We raise a toast. We have a beautiful international dinner. We have always cultural experiences and performances. We typically have a Japanese tea ceremony. We have this year we'll have onboarded the Wobbly World. They're a world music. Music orchestra. They're going to do a live concert for about an hour. They are coming from, you know, I have musicians there from Lebanon, from Cuba, India. We have a beautiful Indian singer. She's actually a doctor at Stanford here, but she's an amazing, amazing singer. Very fortunate to have her there and all the other musicians. So there's that reception and, you know, just fun ambiance, good food, always have wine and beer bar. And then each event is dedicated also to a specific challenge. And this year's event, the format is roundtables. We'll have 5 roundtables, each dedicated to a different challenge within AI's challenge and solutions explorations within mm-hmm. AI's impact areas.
Mm-hmm.
The event itself, I've dedicated it basically to that concept of first global first AI plus human deployment. And how do we build that? How do we enable that so that, you know, time to market or that, you know, near real time deployment, but how do we enable that with of course, accuracy, with, you know, data residency and governance and guardrailing and sovereignty and trust and all those and human input in, you know, every milestone phase of the workflow, and how do we build that adaptability? I think that is the big word with AI's technology, is to build adaptability, adaptability, observability, explainability. Those are mechanisms we must build into our AI infrastructure.
And how do people register for this? Where do they find information? Yeah, if you want to share screen, yeah, go ahead. Yeah, let's share the screen. And for the audience, we'll share the screen here in a second, where you can see where we are going to get you to go register if you're interested in the event itself. So here you go, Talia. So it's yours.
It's on our Global Sake website. So it's globalsakegrowth.com. And then you'll have here at the top tab the 2026 event. Also from the homepage, you can just go there, and you can see also the lock walk and the lock learn, the courses, the upcoming courses and walks. And here is the event. Here is where you can register. We do have a Teams discount. We will be actually closing the registration list in a few days before the event, about 4 days before. So I will urge folks to join as soon as possible. For the last seats, we have very few last seats actually open. And here you can kind of see the.
What's your expectation, Talia? How many people are you expecting?
We capped it at 150. We might be able to bring in a few more, a little bit beyond 150. It's basically, space is huge, but we are targeting 150. And we're very close to that number already. And here you can see the different tracks. So the first one will be focusing more on the platform infra, so backend mid-tier, build that adaptable architecture and integrations. There's a big, you know, in every roundtable track, we'll have open discussions. So the format is an conference. We're mm-hmm. going to talk about whatever the participants want to talk about, but we'll have subject matter expert moderators to lead the conversation. And, you know, there's a big debate now, if you like, about the industry. So we'll be kind of encouraging the debate spirit, right? Of are we building language as a platform layer? Are we building the geocultural context nuance as a platform layer, right? How do we, you know, kind of structure microservice infrastructure, right, for that modularity of performance on the front end? The second track will be focused on data, so infrastructure, but trust, residency, governance, sovereignty, all that good stuff. So more kind of, you know, labeling and annotating and clustering multilingual data. How do we handle low-resourced data and so on, low-resource languages? The third is focused on people. So people is where, you know, we, you know, organizations, companies really need to rethink how they structure teams to enable for that global first rounded circular deployment. Workflows, how do we inform, how do we, you know, what should be centralized, what should be decentralized between HQ and local hubs. Upskilling is a big thing because, as you know, many companies, because of AI's capabilities, many companies are now at best at a hiring freeze. And really, in terms of hiring, they are hiring more experienced engineers and designers and you know, professionals. And so we know that we mostly learn on the job. So what's going to happen to entry level, you know, coming straight out of college or, you know, grad schools and not having the opportunity to learn on the job, right? If we're only hiring for skilled, experienced professionals. So we'll be talking about all those big challenges here. And then the fourth roundtable is dedicated to product. And that is, you know, again, anything to do with the front end UI UX, but how do we optimize product deployment for global first performance with geo fit, right, with market fit for usability. And the final one is on the geocultural context. We'll have Kate, who is she's kind of the guru from the gaming industry. She'll have a lot of very spicy stories to tell us about, you know, especially in sectors like games and TV, streaming, where people consume content in a very emotional way, right? They get attached to the characters, to the plot, to their, you know, game experience. And that geocultural context nuance is really critical to make or break a brand in a new market. So we'll be sharing those very exciting.
Exciting guests you have and moderators.
Yes, yes. Fantastic. And I'm also very happy to share that we have an amazing audience. I mean, the participants, the guests, really very high. So people from, you know, high seniority level with a lot of experience, people more curious. Everyone is an expert in something and everyone has a million blind sides. And we're there to share and learn from each other.
Yeah, that's right. And I was going to make a comment. If somebody thinks that they know it all, that I don't think they need this conference, right, Talia? If you still have some blind sides, I think you should attend.
Yes. Yes. If you just want to have great sake, you know, sake tasting and great food and great music and meet amazing people from around the world, that is an evening for you.
Excellent. No, we're looking forward to it. And thanks for sharing that with everybody. I really appreciate it, Talia. And there's still, like Talia was mentioning, there's still some room if you would like to register. I'm looking forward, and Talia is looking forward to seeing you in San Francisco. And if you need any information, either reach out to me or to Talia. We'll give you the lowdown, or you can head out to the website, globalsakegrowth.com. And if you get stuck, send me a message on LinkedIn. I'll help you through it. And I'm supposed to be one of the ambassadors, aren't I? So I think I've been doing some ambassador's job here. Hang on a second now. I really appreciate that, and it's an honor for me to participate. Appreciate it. Now, let's continue the conversation, if you don't mind. We still have a few minutes to go. AI-powered human solution. So there is a tension when that phrase comes up, right? So everybody who thinks about that, it depends on which side of the fence you're on. You get a different opinion on the matter. Where does AI generally help, and where does it get in the way of real localization quality? And why are we talking about, it just baffles me. Like, I never asked, you know, like when I bought my car, for instance, I never asked the factory, like, what tool did you use to put my car together? What robot did you use? Was the worker skilled in putting this car together? I'm just interested in the product at that point. Like, why are we going down and how the sausage is made in this industry? Like, why are we down that level? There's many things in there, like just conceptually, I like to clear up.
I think that there's a healthy dose of suspicion in the localization industry. And I think also from what I've seen is that the localization industry is probably about 25 years old, let's say, as an industry. And for 20 years, it was pretty stagnant. Let's be honest. Right. I mean, we had localizers that were early adopters of AI, obviously, with NMT, neural machine translation. And that was kind of the big thing. But then there wasn't any additional innovation. You had this TMS, that TMS, right? And, you know, some nice things over here and over there, but pretty much more of the same. A lot of stagnation. And now all of a sudden, things are going to be stirred up and in a very big way that is going to really question maybe even the future of localization. Do we need a new name to define what localization? Do we certainly need a new framing of the workflow and how we integrate and vendor-client relationships? I think all of those things are going to be turned upside down because they're not going to be what they were. And I think in general, people are, you know, people don't like change in general. They like the status quo because it's more.
That's an understatement. They don't like a change. They hate change.
I'm not excited about change, but yeah,
not everybody, of course.
I personally am excited about it, but I very much appreciate the risk and the concern because there is real risk and the concern is justified. Like any big innovation, you know, it can be used for good or for bad, right? So we need to be very careful. But a lot of people talk about agentic first, right? In the build, so agentic AI first. In the kind of, you know, baked as in the platform. And when they talk about agents, you know, a lot of people see it as an autonomous only, right? So, and we'll have, you know, autonomous teams we'll have team agent teams working with each other, right? So where's the human? I think that autonomous does not necessarily mean that it's only the AI agents. I think that it's really critical to have the human expertise, not just in the loop, but in every critical phase of the workflow, especially when it comes to the geocultural context nuance, right? And to any sectarial and use case specific context, because AI can right now, you know, and it'll be better. It can probably render languages pretty well, but I think the input context is not there. And I don't think it will be there very soon. I think we will always, and I think even when it is there, I think we will still need human expertise to guide, to guardrail and govern, but also to input.
Yeah.
So I see it as a double agent. It's the AI and the human working together as double agents.
And do you think
teams of AI agents working together?
But, you know, it's different this time, though. I mean, we've seen technology come and goes in our industry many times, but this one is different, quite different, because we're not waiting 12 months to see the next release of the new features on a software here. This thing is evolving every hour. So whatever we think we know today is going to be different than what we know tomorrow. And as time progresses and moves on, we can't use, in my opinion, that's my humble opinion, absolute statements in this day and age are no longer exist. Like people would say, well, a human will always be involved. Well, how do we know that? That's the current status now. Good. And it's satisfying what we do today. But how do we know that this is going to be the future end state, if you will, forever? I don't think we know that.
We don't know. We absolutely don't know. But I think it's important to be thoughtful about that, right? And aim for that, at least for the near future. I think that we, you know, AI gives us the scale, right? I mean, the local content origination, for example, you know, a lot of things that were holy grail for us in the localization industry that we've always wanted, companies would not prioritize for local content origination because it was too costly. And, you know, overall running a multilingual, multi-geo support was very costly. But I think that, you know, now we are able to take care of the language part, right? And create actual, you know, real-time deployment, local content origination that fits a specific, not just a specific market or region within a market, but also a very specific use case, right? And blur the borders, right? So we're not really talking, I think this is where a major shift will be, which I am personally very excited about, is not looking at even country slice, because even that is not relevant anymore, right? When we look at data analysis, but looking at use case and user intent categories versus country categories, right? Or language categories, like looking at the end, you know, what is the end goal of what we're doing, right? Our end objective is to offer the right fit value add solutions, whether it's a product experience or a content experience in multi-model, right? Whether it's in video, or audio, or visual assets, or content, text, to anyone, any individual, or any, you know, enterprise, wherever they are, whatever language they prefer, and to adapt it to their very specific user needs and use case intent. Mm-hmm. And I think that is, I would like to see the direction going there. I think that is the big opportunity that we have. But we need to be mindful. I mean, we need to envision that, right? I mean, we can only build what we can envision. We need to open our, you know, allow our imagination to expand, because the technology may actually enable us to realize on that imaginary vision.
And, you know, we look at what we've done as an industry and, you know, the metamorphosis that we've been through since 23, 25, 28 years ago till today. It's quite significant. I mean, if I look today, and, you know, everybody can attest to that, and most research companies in or research organization in our industry or outside the industry can attest to that. Content creation is X of what it was. And that most of that content is being translated, most of it. Now, some still need to be worked on and still being in unilingual, I get that. But content that is being translated, it is X what it was before. Now, content creation is like crazy because AI is enabling content creation at a faster and rapid rate. Now, one would question the quality of that content. Okay. But nevertheless, the content is being created. You know, in an absolute sense of the matter, you would think our industry is getting more work. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if you were to say, well, okay, well, we don't have technology now. We're going to go back to doing things the artisan way. Good. Fine. I love being, you know, go to my artisan bakery and buy my bread. That's fine. That's okay. But if we were to rely on that method and that method alone, it sort of defeats the purpose of the industry, which is connecting people together and making people understand each other. I mean, I did a podcast, an entire podcast on, if we understand each other, we have less problems in this world. So the point I was trying to make is, look, technology or no technology, we don't have enough people to do the translation jobs that we need to do. And technology is allowing us to do more translation. It's allowing us to do and communicate better, in my opinion. Now, it needs guardrails, it needs sovereignty, it needs a bunch of things around it. But one would expect whoever is using these technologies is just not just opening out of the box. You know, I hear this all the time on this podcast. I use AI and it didn't work. Explain to me how it didn't work. You can't cut and paste your email into ChatGPT and tell me it didn't work. Well, you didn't tell it anything. It's like, yeah. I gave you the key to my car. You hardly been behind a wheel. And you wrecked the neighbor's lawn. Like, you can't do that. You're not supposed to do that.
Right.
Unfortunately, we're using a lot of these statements out there, right?
Mm-hmm. Right. And this is where you know, human agents and AI agents need to work together. I mean, as humans, we need to partner with our AI and talk to it like a colleague, an experienced mm-hmm. colleague, a colleague that, or it could be maybe an entry-level colleague that doesn't understand, you know, that we really need to explain everything to and with great details and tech specs. You know, the more tech specs we feed it, the better it can perform, give us output. But I would even say that I agree with everything you said. I would just add to that I think that there is, for sure, in the short term, yes, we're going to see, and we are already seeing major layoffs in our industry and in other sectors too. But I think that you know, that we will have new types of jobs that maybe we cannot yet perceive what they are going to be. I can imagine that running, managing AI agents would be a job, you know. Definitely the human role would become more management role, and less, you know, kind of the data, you know, research role. Also, what about all those many, you know, all of us worked in organizations where we could only allow budget resources for, you know, 20, I don't know, maybe 40 languages, right? Like core language sets. And then there were the low resource languages, or maybe like today, you know, a lot of languages that don't have text script, right? That are verbal only. AI can help us with us and maybe even revive extinct languages. We've seen already
preserve
and proliferate, right? Preserve mm-hmm. and proliferate low resource languages, able giving them the stage, giving them the vision, the audio video assets proliferation. And actually, I'm very excited about. I did a post a couple of days ago about. Bashini, right, in India.
I was just going to talk to you about this one. It's next on my list here. I'm glad you brought it up.
Because that's a great example. You know, I've always found it throughout my career, really the best case scenario stories of big success breakthroughs came from a different market where it was off the radar. It was not a market that you thought a big innovation would come out of. But actually, because the market had a core problem, a challenge they had to solve for, whereas in the US we might not have to solve for that. It would be more of a nice to have. In that other market, they had to solve for it, and therefore they did, and therefore we can learn from them, right? We don't have to reinvent the wheel each time. The
100%.
Machine is an example, right? Because India is a market of course, their biggest challenge is that it is a very big, physically very big country with a hyperpopulation. And building for a population scale where you have, you know, they have 22 constitutionalized languages and another 121 widely spoken languages, right? Many in rural areas, right? And the government-led initiative to digitize services across all those language sets in, you know, this is an example of, you know, it supports 500 government websites, right? So, and it's government-led. So it had to have the data residency and governance and sovereignty, right? With, you know, where latency is currency, right? So really building for latency solution, building for accessibility, building for language accessibility and broadband latency accessibility, building for with all the trust and guardrailing and regulatory compliances in place, right? They did it.
Mm-hmm.
And it works. And already there are very high performance results without compromising, you know, not just for scale and speed, but without compromising the trust and the quality. So that's where we need to be always humble and aware.
Learn from others. Learn from how others did this.
Exactly.
That's a teaching. That's a
yes. Yes.
In my opinion, I mean, if they can deal with 22 language constitutionally scheduled 22 languages, mm-hmm. and you know, make something out of it and provide solution for those 22 languages, I just can't imagine like a country would have like two official languages and they're struggling.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Like, I mean, I live in Canada, right? We got two plus the Aboriginal language now. I think 7 languages. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're doing okay, but. We could learn a thing or two from those markets that teaches. I think I love that statement in your post there. Now, you also wrote, Europe regulates, America innovates, China coordinates, and India operationalize inclusion. Where does Canada fit in the map?
You tell me. You're from Canada.
You want me to tell you? I'm waiting for your opinion, but I have my opinion.
I mean, I can make a guess, but I think it's more valuable if you tell us.
Yeah. I think I'll take the liberty of saying that, I guess on our side, and I have a conference coming up at the end of May, we'll be talking about World Speak in the future episodes, but I already did one episode on this one. World Speak is happening at the end of May in Ottawa, just or in Gatineau, which is an adjacent city on the Quebec border. And so we'll be talking a little bit more about this one. Like every other market in our industry, they're going through some transformation here. We're going through a lot of transformation. An adjustment period, I would say the industry is going through. The industry in Canada is primarily driven by government. Government set the policy for languages. They are a big buyer of language services, both translation, written documents, and interpretation. And they are looking for technologies to automate, like everybody else. Content generation is increasing, so they're all looking for ways to automate. and they're looking for ways to use every bit of technology. Now, there's some challenges with government. One is, and specifically regulated industry in Canada, not just government, all regulated industry in Canada. There is the notion of data sovereignty, and you see that everywhere you go. Data sovereignty is top of mind for buyers. The other thing too is with the Canadian industry is that you see a little bit of a layoff too in the, some of the transition companies that are out there. You know, before I left my previous job, we had to do a few of those. But I mean, you contract and you increase as with the business, right? So if the business goes up, you hire. If it doesn't, well, your most expensive resource in your business generally is people. So you do that. Also, the transition industry also right now is, in general in Canada, is going through a phase that all buyers, I think, they're going through the Buy Canada review. So they are reviewing most of the regulated industry and the non-regulated industry that prefer to buy from Canadian institutions or Canadian companies. There was a policy which was issued by the government a few months ago now. It's under, and all the other departments are reviewing this right now. It's called Buy Canada policy that was announced by the government. So these are the highlights, the major highlights. Obviously, there's many details around that, but that's the status in Canada.
Yeah. And it's interesting because there's always friction, you know, when you optimize for speed and volume and quality, right? Versus optimize for compliance and governance, right? And trust that always slows you down, right? So there's that, oh, we can go so much farther and in depth, but are we building it in a sustainable, yeah, responsible way, right? So that friction between the two is always very interesting. And I would definitely say that, you know, with the evolving technology, and you mentioned, as its AI's, capabilities are going to expand and explode, and with quantum computing even further, the technology is advancing way faster than our human ability to adapt. And certainly not at all, like, it leaves regulations and compliance light years behind, right? So it couldn't possibly catch up to technology because by in nature, it has to be a more slow and thoughtful process. So that would be, and we'll be talking about that at the Global Forest.
Yeah, I'd love to engage in that conversation. There's a lot of examples here, so. Mm-hmm. So in your opinion, I guess I've got a couple of more questions. I guess we'll wrap it up. So if one of our listeners is listening to this conversation saying, wow, this is interesting, I'd like to get involved here. What is the career advice you wish someone had given you before your first global product launch? What would you do to advise somebody on that?
Always always question, and there's always another way. So if you feel like I'm stuck on this, because I don't have enough resources or budget, or because the technology, the system, our systems is built is going to provide these roadblocks, that we're stuck on something, there's always a way. Every way you choose also has a trade-off. Yes, you gain something and you lose something. It's always a choice. Remember that there's always a choice, and you need to be thoughtful about, of course, you want to make informed decisions. Yes, so you know, as much as you can gather information ahead of time, but there's always a way and there's always a choice, and your choice makes an impact, and dare to take intelligent risks.
That's right. And I want to thank you for today's conversation, Talia. That was very lovely to first meet you and have this dialogue together. Is there anything else that we have not yet covered that you wish to cover?
I think we covered it all. I would also just like want to kind of give a little shout out to, first of all, to Adobe, who is hosting us at this amazing event in their
big shout out to them.
Beautiful space. So super grateful specifically to Priscilla Noble and Yuki Shioka, to the amazing team, and to the amazing team for you as an ambassador, and for the roundtable moderators, and for everyone participating and joining us. And also a little shout out to the Lock Learn School. Check out the programs. We're the next course. So we've had Rafal teach building agentic AI applications for product and localization. And we are going to launch the level 2 of that. So the next level up, where we're going to do some vibe coding using the NitIn platform and other tools. And another very exciting new course coming up in May is AI, using the latest AI tools, NanoBanana and many others, to adapt and to create visual assets. So audio, video, visual assets images, of course, for the world.
Oh, perfect, perfect. And how do people get engaged with the LocLearn? Is that like online? Is it in school, physically? How do you do that?
Yeah, so it's on the Global Sake website, go to the LocLearn tab and you will see the different courses. All the courses are live Zoom with participants from around the world. The trainers are also from different parts of the world. So it's also really nice, and it's in real time. So it's live Zoom. It's a great way to also connect, build relationships with other leads from around the world. And yeah, you can just sign up online registration.
Absolutely. I want to thank you so much, Talia, for joining me today. I really appreciate it. Any final
thoughts? Thank you so much. Thank you so much. Final thought, you know, we live in a crazy world right now, and we just need to, you know, my mom always said, you cannot hate the person whose story you know. So let's always keep our antennas open and be embracive of other and tolerant to other cultures and other regional environments and other perspectives and other values and other thought processes. And always remember that more is unveiled than veiled. There's more that we don't know than we know, right? So always to
the epitome of the tip of the iceberg conversation, right?
The iceberg?
What is it? Yeah, so the tip of the iceberg, yeah.
Yes, absolutely. And to be aware, we tend to forget that, right? To always remember. Yeah.
So I want to thank you so much, Talia Baruch, for joining me today. I really appreciate it. Thanks for being a guest on the Localization Fireside Chat. It's your first time. And I would love for you to come back and do another update whenever you feel like it. Consider this channel is your channel. Anytime you need a voice out there, I hope you consider me and consider this channel your go-to. I really appreciate your being here, you're sharing your knowledge, you're sharing your wisdom with us, with me and the audience. I know I've learned a lot from you today, and I'm sure the audience got pleasure of learning from you as well and getting to meet you and getting to know you. For the audience, I want to thank you so much for joining me on this episode. And we're marking episode 200 on this one. And it's quite significant, 2.5 years, 200 episodes. Something is going right, I feel. And I want to thank you, the audience, and the guests who prepared to come prepare for this conversation and spend the time to talk to you. Thanks for watching us on YouTube. Thanks for listening to us on the podcast channel. And thanks for reading the blog post as well, where we summarize all these conversations on robinayoub.blog. Feel free to browse through the previous conversations as well. You may find something of interest to you there. And I'll see you at the next episode. Talia, thanks so much. And I'll see you there.